Hey everybody, quick update on the World SF Tour fundraiser to get me to Worldcon. We are currently just $2 away from the $250 mark, which is the second milestone. At that particular point, one lucky donor will actually get to pick a book for Paul to read for the Mining the Asteroid feature, which would be really cool just to see what somebody will pick. And I also did want to let you know that the first milestone perk, which was an entry in the Alt History Encyclopedia Confectura, and it was on the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II, which was a joy to write about and make up totally not real history about. All of this stuff, the information about the fundraiser and the link to reading the selections can be found if you just go to skiffingfanny.com and you go to the little sidebar there, you'll see a link to the GoFundMe page. Do please donate as well. If you can donate anything, even $5 is fine. Every little bit is going to help me get closer. And of course, if you've already donated, do, share it with people and point them our way, you know? So thank you for everybody that donated. Hopefully we will have the second perk, at least, achieved, and then we can start working on the next piece. So thanks again, and I hope you enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the It.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 194.
Gods, Circuses, and Beach Dancing with Adam Christopher.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And our special guest today is Adam Christopher. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Hey, hello.
Excellent. So I want to start with the really big quick question, which is our new introductory question now, for at least for the interviews we've been doing since Nick Mamatas was on the show and burned me to little itty bitty pieces. I'm just teasing. But the question is, what kind of continues to draw you to more broadly genre fiction, since that's primarily what you're known for writing? So what is it that continues to make you interested in this particular field?
That's a really, really good question. I do read a lot of stuff which is not genre, but really genre, sort of speculative fiction is where I kind of hang around, because you can do anything with it. Within genre fiction, you can do any kind of subgenre. You can do crime and horror, and as well as big things like fantasy and science fiction and urban fantasy. And I love it because you really don't know what's coming. You know, any book that you pick up or are recommended or someone sends you or you discover, there can be anything in there. And to me, that's pretty amazing, really.
So it's the fact that there's almost no rules on what to expect. It could literally be anything.
Some forms of some literary genres, you're kind of more restricted because, even science fiction things has rules and stuff. But yeah, it's basically just anything can happen. Expect the unexpected.
Yeah, I like that. I like, because you're right, too. And there's some degree to which I think SFNF in some areas has been pushing some of the boundaries. I think in fantasy in particular, like, it wasn't very common before to have fantasy, which would include things based on stuff that wasn't Western in origin, and that's becoming a little bit more common, which really exciting, I think, for me. Or even something like Kevin Hearn. I don't know if everyone familiar with Kevin Hearn's work?
Yes.
The Iron Druids, yeah.
I love those books, because the first time I read that first book, it was all of the gods are there, and there's a scene where the main character goes to get, I think it's arrows, to get blessed by... it was a Virgin Mary who's hanging out in an alley, like helping homeless people in the middle of town. And it's just the idea of that is, because
it's so removed from what we understand it would be the natural reference to her. It's like, no, she's like hanging out in an alley somewhere doing her thing.
I call it godpunk.
Godpunk.
Oh yeah.
I think Hangwire definitely falls into that godpunk tradition.
Well, that's an interesting thing. So I see, Paul, you had a hand, so you may want to ask yourself about this.
Well, actually, I want to ask about something else going back a few seconds. Okay. So you mentioned before about crime and noir and investigation. I noticed, Adam, that seems to be in a lot of your novels, in Empire State, in The Age Atomic, in Hangwire. There's a definite crime or noir investigative element to all those novels. Do you see those novels as being genre with crime elements, or do you see crime as the chassis and genre as the body on top of that chassis? Which came first? Which is the cart and which is the horse? Is what I'm really asking.
Yeah. I think I wrote them as science. Well, Empire State and The Age Atomic, to me, science fiction novels. First, and they just have other stuff kind of plugged into it. I mean, obviously, you know, Empire State, which is a detective story, you know, the main character is a private eye, mm-hmm. so that's very much part of the structure of it and kind of the form of the story, but definitely it's based on a science fiction kind of idea that I had. And obviously The Age Atomic, being the sequel to that, continues that kind of crimey, hard-boiled type thing. But again, it's got, you know, atomic robots and
yes.
quantum ghosts and things like that. So it's definitely science fiction. I mean, Hangwire is, to me, an urban fantasy, first and foremost, which includes godpunk, which is what you mentioned just before. But, I mean, it's got kind of horror elements in it. And it's got kind of crime stuff in it, although it's a little bit removed. Like, for example, although there's a serial killer, and obviously the San Francisco where it's set is kind of in the grips of this kind of fear of the Hangwire killer, it's not really a procedural. There's no kind of police involvement because the characters are removed from it. Otherwise I'd get kind of bogged down in detective stuff. You know, Seven Wonders, which is my second novel, which is a superhero novel, actually has some police as some of the main characters.
Yeah.
So that was like a superhero slash crime slash police procedural, sort of. But yeah, I think crime and noir and hard-boiled and procedural, they're kind of things that I read a lot of and I really enjoy. So yeah, I kind of tend to switch back into that. I think at some point I'll probably write it like a straight crime novel, you know, if I can resist putting in something that's kind of fantastical.
You could always like just sneak in something that's a little odd that's actually fantastic, but don't tell anybody.
Yeah, well, you're right. This is the kind of thing of like you do a genre novel that is presented as a mainstream novel, that seems to be something that people quite like. I mean, think of something like The Shining Girls by Lauren Bucus, which is basically about a time-traveling serial killer.
Yeah.
But it's a mainstream thriller, you know. The speculative stuff is just kind of like a little sparkle on the inside.
That book's creepy.
Yes.
It's excellent, but it's creepy.
but I do agree that's much more in the crime school with a dash of SF thrown in rather than the reverse. And I was just wondering how you saw your own work. I hadn't thought of Seven Wonders as having the police, but yeah, that's right. There are police characters. I keep remembering that as a superhero novel first and foremost because yeah. It just struck me that way.
Well, I guess because the police, well, it is. And again, when I wrote it, I thought I'm going to write a superhero novel with like spandex and laser beams and robots and stuff. The police were kind of part of the story and they get more involved as it goes along. Like with Hangwire, because I had a killer kind of in the story, I knew that if I had the police involved, it would become a completely different book. It would get tangled up in the whole police side of things, which is another story, and it's not the one I wanted to write. It's actually interesting. One of the characters, Ted, is a blogger, and originally, in the original version, he was like a newspaper reporter, which is kind of like a bit of a cliche. But then I realized that he couldn't be, because otherwise he would get too drawn into the kind of police side of things, which is not what I wanted to do. So he's a cultural sort of events blogger.
Yeah, and I mean, the book even makes very clear that the blog that they write about doesn't cover all of this
stuff. It says somewhere that they don't cover news.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, the TMZ for the local area, but, right. You know, less sleazy. That's actually a terrible reference. I probably shouldn't use TMZ.
It's more like, you know, restaurant reviews and what's going on this weekend.
Which would make sense for the area. I mean, San Francisco is one of those areas where those kinds of things would serve a very valuable purpose. I mean, I've lived in the Bay Area, so finding where this is a good place to be is actually kind of difficult in such a huge place. So you kind of have to rely on either the local newspapers or, I imagine increasingly so with now blogs.
Right, yeah.
So, but okay, so that's... I actually wanted to ask about this because now we're talking about the location, and I think this is great that we got to this sort of organically, that I'm curious why you chose San Francisco as the place to... I mean, I suspect you have some idea because there's an event in the beginning that's important, but what was the kind of impetus for selecting San Francisco as the main place you'd focus on?
I was in San Francisco a few years ago and really kind of fell in love with the place. It reminds me a lot of Auckland, New Zealand, where I'm from. The same kind of layout with, the water and the bay and things like that. Auckland is not anywhere near as hilly as San Francisco. But I had a really good time there, and I knew that I really wanted to set something there at some point. And like Hangmyer is actually based on a true story, kind of. Because when I was there, I went to a Chinese restaurant in Chinatown and we had dinner and then we had fortune cookies, and it was kind of the whole just an everyday Saturday night out, except my fortune cookie was kind of weird. It was like a factory fault, reject one that had accidentally got packaged. So I cracked it and it kind of shattered. It was like a thicker kind of pastry. It kind of shattered. And inside, instead of just one strip of paper, was like a ball of fortunes.
Wow.
I was like, okay, that's cool. And then I opened them up and they all said the same thing, which was, you are the master of every situation.
No way.
Yeah, this is right. And this is like, I thought, that's okay. First of all, that's a really kind of cool fortune. Like, it's kind of better than average than what you get out of a fortune cookie. And I had like 20 of them. And I thought, okay, well, that's also kind of weird. So I kept them. I've got a few of them somewhere. But I thought, kind of going home that night, that would either make a really good kind of Silver Age Marvel superhero origin story. You know, this guy, there's like a cosmic fortune cookie that explodes and he gets granted powers or something. Or if it's not that, then it's like maybe there was something hidden inside a fortune cookie by some mysterious power, and the guy that gets it, like, he's the wrong recipient. He wasn't supposed to get it. So that's basically where the story started from. I loved San Francisco, and then I had that kind of slightly odd experience.
It's weird how that works. Like, real life is providing these oddities, because that is actually really strange when you think about it.
Like I said, I'm sure that it's just a faulty fortune cookie, of course.
Mm-hmm. No, it's not. It's a sign. Happened.
Yeah.
Well,
the book is a true story, kind of.
it takes a piece from the real life, and it obviously takes some stuff from what happened in San Francisco's past. I mean, your opening chapters are focused on the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, which I imagine a lot of the U.S. listeners are at least familiar with the fact that it basically destroyed San Francisco. And I really found it interesting because there are some details in here that I didn't know. Like, I had no idea that the military had actually tried to use dynamite to create a firewall.
Yeah.
And so to see that here, but obviously you'd use it for a different purpose. because there are other things going on. I don't think it's really ruining anything. It's like in the first chapter. There's some creepy stuff going down.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, one, what was kind of the reason you kind of decided to use this particular moment in San Francisco's history as sort of the, like, almost like the frame that the for the novel structure, at least. And then sort of like the second idea is your desire to kind of rewrite the history to include, to take it so that this earthquake is no longer just the earthquake. It now contains this supernatural or horrific aspect to it. And that sort of reverberates throughout the novel because it sets the tone, I think, for what follows.
I mean, you know, American history is something that I'm really fascinated with, and it's something that I've used in my other books. So having been to San Francisco and, like, really, you know, got into the city, I was obviously aware of its history, especially the kind of the geological history and the earthquakes of, you know, 1906 and 1989. Excuse me. Also kind of similar to New Zealand, because New Zealand is a place of earthquakes as well. And there have been some pretty major ones, you know, in the early 20th century as well as more recently. So, you know, the first idea for the story always kind of centered around there being something underneath San Francisco, and that was related to the earthquakes. So then it was a matter of kind of just researching the history, which I was doing anyway, because, as I said, that's the kind of thing that I am into. But yeah, you mentioned, like, you know, the military were dynamiting streets to make a fire break in 1906. And this is the kind of detail that you kind of grab onto and think, well, that's really, really weird. And what if they were actually dynamiting for something else? Which you find out in the first chapter. It was also kind of handy because some of the characters in the book, you know, they exist outside of time in a way. So I really wanted to show that these guys had been around in the city for a lot longer than everybody else. And also, you know, the idea that there's kind of three events. There's the 1906 earthquake, there's the 1989 earthquake, and then there's something else coming. So it kind of, especially for poor old Bob, who's a kind of surfer guy who teaches ballroom dancing on the beach, he's been there before and he probably knows what's coming. Only this time he maybe has a chance to stop it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was reading something when I was doing a little sort of quick research myself on the earthquake. There's talk that those earthquakes were part of a trilogy, as it were, that there is supposed to be another one coming, which I'm sure San Franciscoans are talking about constantly, about the Armageddon earthquake to come.
Yeah, and this is, again, this is... In New Zealand, you know, Wellington, the capital city, even other, you know, other places, they're always kind of looking to the next big earthquake that's going to wreck everything. So it's something that I kind of am aware of and grew up with.
It's something that I'm from California, so we kind of...
Right. Well, exactly. Yeah. And New Zealand and California are on the Ring of Fire, the Pacific Ring of Fire. So it's all kind of connected.
Yeah, it's interesting that we just share that experience, and I mean, it's just weird to live in a place where there, because anybody who's never lived in a place with earthquakes, I guess, doesn't quite understand, because they have other natural disasters they're worried about. Like with earthquakes, you can't even predict them.
Yeah.
You're just like, yeah, we're supposed to have one at some point, but it could be, you know, a 18 bazillion .0, or it could just be a 1 and nobody will know. And I do like it. I think it's really funny when you have people who don't come from earthquake areas, and they'll be like a really small earthquake, and they're like, "Oh my god, everything's gonna fall apart!" And you're like, "Yeah, that was like barely even a 2. You don't know what an earthquake is yet. I've slept through earthquakes."
Right. Yeah, I mean, yeah, my wife is from Christchurch, which was hit by a big earthquake a couple of years ago, which basically wrecked the city.
Oh, goodness.
So I've kind of, we were, you know, obviously affected by that.
That's terrible. Yeah. I missed the Los Angeles earthquake, the big one in oh god, I forget what year it was.
94, the Northridge?
Yeah, the huge one where all of the overpasses collapsed. And
yeah, I think that was 94.
Yeah, I was living up north, but we had family living there, and remember watching it on the news and just seeing all of these roads, these immense concrete structures just gone. So, yeah, it's very weird. But I'm sorry, it's kind of going into like real personal kind of stuff. But I see, Paul, you had a hand, so why don't you jump in?
I did. I just want to say the largest earthquake I experienced in California was just a four-pointer in my 8 months there. So I guess I'm lucky that way.
Mm.
But anyway, going back to history, you mentioned that the San Francisco earthquake is one of the frames of this novel. The other frame, the other through line is seeing Joel through different points in time in history. And I was just curious as to, you mentioned you were a history buff, but I was curious as to why you picked those particular points in history. You start off with the opening of Oklahoma and gradually bring him through to the present day at various points in history. I was just curious as to how you chose those places in space and time.
Joel is my favorite character in the book because, being the villain, he was really easy to write. And basically, he wrote himself. And in fact, in the earlier version of the book, he was only in a few scenes. And then I realized that he needed to tell this other story, which is, as you describe, it's this journey of his across the 20th century from, the Oklahoma land rush to the present. What I did for that was explore kind of this Fortean interest of mine. I grew up enjoying ghost stories and UFO stories and kind of monsters and Bigfoot and the Jersey Devil and all that kind of stuff, which I find really, really fascinating. And I mean, to give listeners a kind of idea, Joel is, he finds something in the Oklahoma land rush in a cave that has fallen from a comet, whenever that was. And this kind of, it's kind of like a power that possesses him, and it drives him to his destiny, he says, underlined, in San Francisco in the present. And the idea being that this presence kind of leaks evil into its surroundings. It leaches into the ground, like physically and kind of metaphorically. So it infects a circus where Joel works, and this is the kind of the circus that we also see in the present. But the circus is split up after some kind of weird happenings in 1900 Philadelphia, I think. And then the power kind of compels Joel to go across the states and collecting pieces of it to try and reassemble it. So the points that I chose were kind of events in time which are unexplained and weird, and kind of there's a possibility of evil, sort of cosmic evil having an influence. This is because the pieces of the circus that have been scattered are kind of leeching this power into the surroundings. So I've got things like there's the collapse of the can't remember the Silver River Bridge in somewhere. the Mothman prophecies, the whole in the 60s, the bridge collapse. Yeah. So he's there when that happens. He's there when a plane crashes mysteriously. He's in New Orleans in a haunted house. He chases the Jersey Devil through the Pine Barrens of New Jersey. He's in Hawaii when there's a serial killer there. So there's kind of points that I know from my kind of interest in weird stuff happening. And I thought it would be cool that if that was actually all kind of connected in some way.
I mean, I'm familiar with the Jersey Devil having lived in New York City. I didn't realize, and I kind of, the Mothman sounded, I didn't realize they were all based on real Fortean stuff that you had just thrown in. That's even cooler. Wow. I thought they were, except for the Oklahoma March, I thought they were mostly imaginary doings, but I didn't realize you actually took real unexplained events and threw them into the narrative. That's excellent.
And I think it's like one per decade that I managed to find. Some obscure, some Less so. But, I mean, there's one, I think, in Texas, there's like the, during the Dust Bowl, which is not necessarily a 14 event, but there was a town in Texas that was completely destroyed by a dust storm, like buried totally.
Yeah, that was creepy.
Yeah, so maybe because he was there looking for something. It's a kind of fun thing to do, especially with a character like that, where, as I said, like with the others, he exists outside of time in a way, which gave me the kind of freedom to kind of just go crazy. And he was so cool to write. He's like, he was so much fun. I want to use him in something else, but I'm not quite sure how to kind of extricate him from his fate.
You could always write a prequel.
Yeah, well, and he was like traveling the States for 100 years, so yeah.
There's all kinds of stories you could tell, yeah.
Yeah.
So, always an option. You could write a novella about him.
Then yeah.
Put it on the interwebs.
I could.
You could? Yeah.
Good.
Well, okay, so this, not quite related, but one of the questions I was really curious about, too, is about there are aspects of this book, and I know in previous interviews with, I think with Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing or something, you said something to the effect that you don't really think about genre. When you write, you just kind of write and stuff happens. It's kind of a poor paraphrase, but there are aspects of this book that I think are, if not horror, certainly the macabre. They're very creepy at times. There's almost a, I would use a reference to like a Lovecraft, but I don't think that's quite accurate, but just to give people a sense of the kinds of horrific ideas that you kind of weld into here in terms of some of the creatures and things. And I'm curious, if did you see yourself creating that kind of an atmosphere that was disturbing, or were you just kind of inserting weird stuff into this because it was kind of going with some of the other stuff we're talking about, where like manipulating history and making the reasons behind why things happen, just making them a little more supernatural?
I think kind of a bit of both. I mean, I love kind of cosmic horror, the kind of Lovecraftian thing. And not just cosmic, but kind of nameless and shapeless horror. Because I'm not really a horror fan at all. It's not something I enjoy reading. I don't really think it actually works as a standalone genre. I much prefer to think of it as a kind of flavor that you can kind of apply to other things. A bit like noir. I mean, noir does not mean crime or hard-boiled. It means something else entirely. But you can put noir into science fiction or crime or whatever. So definitely there's kind of horror tones here and there. Because the story I had was about a kind of nameless, shapeless, formless, cosmic entity. In fact, there's two in the book. It's a lot of kind of about atmosphere and mystery. I do love that. I mean, yeah, Lovecraft is one of my favorite authors, despite his nature.
I did notice a line which was straight out of Lovecraft in the novel. Oh. I thought, yes. just a catchphrase, like yes, because I suspect this is he go angling for Lovecraft with this, and so I was like, yes he is.
What line is that?
The star and the stars were right.
Oh yeah.
I picked up the right away. Like, okay, my suspicions are confirmed.
Well, yeah, and the fact that Joel, the bad guy, he finds this thing that fell off a comet. Well, it suggested it fell off a comet. This is something that came up during my research into earthquakes in California. Comets have always been seen as a kind of ominous object. Mm-hmm. And all through human history have been associated with disasters and famine and natural disasters and earthquakes and floods and whatever. And in fact, at the beginning of the book, there's all these kind of newspaper clippings from the 19th century, of people blaming comets for things, including earthquakes. And the whole kind of cosmic horror thing, that there's stuff out there which is like totally malevolent. It kind of all tied together. So yeah, kind of definitely a kind of cosmic horror thing. Although again, you know, it's an urban fantasy which has got some kind of dark bits in it. It's I mean, I've used horror in other things as well, but again, it's like it's a tone sort of thing.
Mm, yeah, and I like that aspect of this a lot. I think because some of the things you create are, they don't even have to be horrific in what they do; just their very presence is really creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the whole thing, yeah, it's what you don't see or can't see.
Yeah. I mean, even the opening chapters, I mean, the very first chapter, there's this moment when he's hears these people saying, crying, help me, and he's trying to pull these people out of this, like, rift, and it's never explicitly said, although I think that you're led to believe that they're not people. That's not what's happening here. Like, people as we understand people. And he's like trying to help, and all of the military guys are going, no, no, don't touch them. And it's just this creepy moment just right from the start. And it just sets the tone, I feel, throughout the book for, even when it comes to something I'm going to ask about later, like the creepy circus stuff. It's really well handled, I think. So, thank you for giving me nightmares eventually, because that's what I'm gonna hear somebody cry help me, and I'm gonna look to the ground and hope I haven't stepped on something that's gonna eat my heart. It's gonna be horrible.
Black hand coming out of the ground.
Oh god, that's terrifying. It's like there aren't a lot of things that are actually scary anymore for me, because like I've seen enough horror movies. Like slasher flicks don't really work into me anymore, because they're mostly just bad. It's just about gore. But, like, there are some things that, you know, like, zombies and, like, creepy undead creature monsters that, like, want to pull me into the earth. I'm out.
That's it.
Yeah, those are things that scare me. If that happens in real life, I am holding up my house. I'm barricading the door. You won't see me until it's over. Done.
Yeah, I agree.
It's way too creepy. But, okay, so I mentioned it already, but I do want to ask about the circus. Because the circus plays a pretty big role here, particularly with Joel, who has a particular role. And I believe I got the character right. I got the correct character, Joel?
Joel, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yep. I'm just making sure, 'cause there are quite a few characters, and I didn't want to get the wrong name. And I mean, obviously there are other characters involved in variations of the circus, but his particular role is, I think, really interesting. I mean, he does eventually basically get shot. Sort of, and I won't explain that. You can read the book and find out what that means. But I'm really curious, A, why did you kind of pick the circus as a space you really wanted to kind of explore? And I guess an aspect of that is what kind of draws you to the circus as a place, and just kind of talking about the way in which it plays into this particular work.
Yeah, I guess circuses are something that kind of comes and goes in... fantasy fiction. There's kind of like waves of psychic circuses and horror circuses and that kind of thing. So I guess for me, well, the origin was the fairground more than the actual kind of big top. This kind of idea of one of those Transformer toys that was like five separate things and then they unite to form Predator King, and I can't remember the name of the other one, Brutalicus, something like that. Anyway, you know, so you have individual parts, and then they form something which is more than the sum of the parts. So that was kind of the idea behind the fairground, and that the evil that had come with Joel, which had kind of infected the fairground machines, and when they all kind of got put together, more than meets the eye, right? Yeah, and they kind of form the thing. And there's a point in the book where they actually point out that in San Francisco is the first time when they've been able to get all the machines out properly in this big field. So it's like it's kind of reached a critical mass, which is the whole point. They were all the kind of the evil power was driving towards this moment in San Francisco where everything would kind of align, like when the stars are right. And it all come together. But yeah, you know, circuses are kind of fun. Well, they're kind of fun in that they're very easy to turn into a creepy thing, which is this kind of weird. I mean, everyone says that clowns are scary, but...
Scary.
Which is actually interesting. I don't think there's a clown in the book.
Don't remember one. You have other creepy things.
There's like a... There's a what, sorry?
You have other creepy things, but I don't remember any real clowns.
Yeah, there's a mention of clowns in one of the chapters, but they're not. They're not.
And there's a guy who's kind of hanging around. He's like in charge of the clowns, but he's only a kind of minor role. But I think just the whole circus thing in general is so kind of odd when you think about it. That makes it appealing to use in fantasy. Because a circus is a fantasy, and it doesn't take much to kind of push it into a stranger, more magical direction. Especially with Joel there and his machines that he talks to at night.
I wonder if it has something to do, and I don't know because I don't know the history of circuses, but it seems to me that some aspect of it must be that generally speaking, the circus is, it's mobile, it moves about, so unlike... You know, we build these little communities or cities and whatnot. They're very stable. There's rules everybody kind of follows. But the circus doesn't. It's not a part of that. So on some level, it's always figured as being outside because it's constantly moving, and it brings, of course, things with it that aren't part of your daily life because, well, clowns don't run around town. Maybe not in your town. I wonder if that's some aspect. I don't know if you'd agree with that, but maybe. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, no, for sure. It's definitely, there's an outsider quality to circuses. And the way that they move, they can appear and disappear. And again, because they're disconnected from the kind of rest of society, which again makes it really easy to make them kind of weird.
Yeah.
And scary.
Yeah, interesting. Go ahead, Paul.
It's like a mobile Brigadoon. It appears, it disappears. You generally see stuff coming out of the circus. I mean, circuses are generally very self-contained. I mean, there might be an occasional parade. I know we used to do Ringling Brothers parades in New York City for a while. But generally, the circus is a place that comes and you go to it, and it's a magical different place that you're into for a little while, and then you leave. And then the circus goes somewhere else. There's very much a sense of boundary and crossing over from our world into fairy, for lack of a better word, and kind of coming out again, transformed.
And also there's the whole thing of like, it'd be easy to hide something in a circus because a circus presents a fantastical image to the outside world, which is how they attract people to come in and see it. But like, it's hard to tell where the boundary is between what is merely an act and what is something beyond not supernatural, but you know, beyond normal experience.
Yeah.
So Joel can hide it. Joel and his machines can exist quite happily inside the circus, and people don't quite know if he's just a crazy guy or there's something else going on.
I did have a question about the structure of this, of how you set up the circus. It almost feels like there's, I shouldn't say two poles. There seems to be two centers. Or maybe I was misreading the novel. You do have Joel on the one end, but then you also have the dancers who almost seem semi-independent power of their own in this circus. I don't know if you intended to write that way. It almost felt like you had these two centers of creepiness in the side of the circus. And I don't know if I was misreading that or...
Oh, no,
I was just asking about that.
Yeah. So there's a kind of Celtic dance troupe in the book who... It's basically, they're kind of fake anyway because it's just, they've made it up. But they kind of regress into this more and more primitive state, and they light a big bonfire and they start digging underneath the fire because there's kind of things under the ground. That's almost like a side effect of what's going on in the circus. Because, Joel, he actually fights with the guy from the dancers at one point.
Yeah, which is why I was thinking.
Yeah. It's the whole
thing. They're fighting for dominance, yeah.
Yeah. It's because the evil that's leeching out of all of everything that Joel has and infecting everything else. So it's because it's all based on belief and Joel's own thoughts. And he's very much responsible for shaping. It's getting a bit vague here, but he's kind of responsible for shaping kind of what's going on. Mm-hmm. So the dancers, because they've got this kind of fake thing that they have created for themselves, it kind of gets corrupted by the thing that's asleep underneath the city and by the thing that's living inside the fairground machines. So it's almost like a side effect of Joel and what he wants to do. But as the book goes on, they kind of get more and more involved with actually what's happening, especially when it comes to things that they kind of dig out of the ground, which I'm not going to spoil.
No, we shouldn't spoil it. It's creepy. It's creepy, readers. You should read it, but we're not going to spoil it.
No, no.
And yeah, and also there's some bits where, yeah, out in the city, people actually start fighting in the streets in a couple of points. It's kind of subtle, but that's because as things are heading towards this third calamity, it's kind of, and the power's increasing, the kind of the spreading of the evil. It's a kind of, it's a vague, it's one of these things, again, it's like the kind of vague, nebulous, cosmic horror type thing, which is kind of cool because it doesn't, I don't need to define it exactly. It's up to the reader.
Yeah, and I think part of what is interesting is in not in being able to define it is that it redirects the focus to what really matters, which is how people react to it, whatever right. is going on. I mean, it doesn't matter if there's no answer. At the end of the day, that's not that the horror is actually in how people react to this. And in some cases, they don't react very well.
Right.
I won't ruin that. There's some bad stuff going on. I mean, there are murders. I'll just put that there are quite a lot of people die. Too many. I mean, it's not like, you know, like entire cities are like turned into bloody paste, but enough. Enough people die that it's at times sometimes rather brutal. But I mean, obviously, because one of the characters we'd mentioned was the serial killer, from which I think it's fair to say that the book gets its title, The Hangwire, because he's called that. They call him the Hangwire Killer. I'm curious, did you actually do research on serial killers? I mean, you must have done a little bit, because I believe you mentioned one of the San Francisco serial killers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That comes from an interesting kind of crime fiction. You kind of get into true crime stuff. So, yeah, my internet search history... It's probably a scary place. If anyone finds it,
we won't tell the NSA.
Exactly. I find serial killers kind of fascinating, and I mean, well, that's real life horror, isn't it? You know. doesn't need to be. You don't need to fictionalize that. But yeah, it needed deaths.
I too am a little bit fascinated by serial killers. Maybe I should be a little worried about saying that publicly. I agree with you that it's sort of the horror that's in the real life. And it's, again, it's one of the scenarios where it's often because nobody suspects it. It comes out of nowhere. I mean, some of the worst American serial killers, people would have thought, I never would have thought that person would have been a serial killer. They seem so normal. And in retrospect, we go, no, he wasn't. But, you know, we don't see that because we expect, at least on some level, that your neighbor is not a psycho killer eating people doing.
And again, that's part of what makes it fascinating, because it's like, it's fantasy versus reality. What they present and what is actually going on are different things.
Yeah. Yeah, it has, a different kind of effect on us, and it also reminds us that some aspects of humanity are not great. it's a side of us that, you know, there is a darkness to the human self, or whatever you want to call it, the human species, that we don't, perhaps on some level, we don't want to acknowledge in our daily lives, because it's better to think better of people, I think, maybe as a culture we think that, but... I certainly don't think anybody that lives near me is a serial killer, but
well,
then again, I live in Gainesville, so that's mean. I shouldn't say that about Gainesville. anyway, Paul, did you, I don't know if the hand that was there was one that you'd put before.
It was one I put before, but I snuck in the question in the middle of the conversation, but I did have jumping topic slightly. So you have Joel dealing with the outer dark, and we've touched on this before, and you have the circuses. So why gods, and why and these are not the usual suspects for gods that you would find generally in an urban fantasy, which was kind of reminded me of your fellow Angry Robot author Gwenda Bond's The Woken Gods.
Yeah.
I made that connection. Like, here's an unusual set of gods. I was just curious as to why these gods rather than some of the more usual suspects. How did you come to choose them?
It was one of those things where I was halfway through and I realized that Bob and a couple of the other characters were not... I mean, I knew they weren't people, but I didn't really know what they were. And then I realized halfway through what they were, which are kind of the last members of a kind of forgotten pantheon of gods, which kind of turned the book into god punk, which is what you're saying at the beginning, which is where you kind of use... mythological characters that exist in our own cultures in fiction. So I thought, if I'm going to do gods, then I'm not going to do the usual kind of, Greek gods, Roman gods, Egyptian gods, that kind of thing. I want to choose something kind of different. And I kind of just started researching it. And again, there's something I'm kind of interested in because of, I like... apart from history and things and Fortania, like just weird and strange customs and stories and urban legends and myths. So I came across the ones that fitted kind of perfectly in the story. Bob is he's from somewhere else. I'm not gonna say where from.
I didn't spoil in my own review. I want readers to come across that. Yes, he's a god, but he's not the god you expect he is.
Right, and it's actually interesting because, like, when I was researching him in particular, a lot of the stuff that you read about the real identity of his character, people actually don't really know if it's the true myth or if it's what Christian missionaries kind of implanted upon it afterwards, which is kind of interesting. And being that the whole book is about kind of belief and what you think might be there, and Bob himself is not really sure because. All through the book, he's trying not to use his powers because he's afraid that a side of him will come out that he can't control. Even though he's a good guy, and like he's been in San Francisco for years entertaining tourists, and he's a nice guy, but maybe he's got some other side of him. So it's really fascinating to find stuff that people, haven't really used in fiction, but fitted the story. And the other one, there's a character that appears called Tangun the Founder, who is this kind of warrior king from Korean mythology. And he just seemed really cool.
Because
he can just like appear on top of buildings and start shouting at people because he's kind of ready for war. He's in this big kind of armor and he's got his swords. He's fun.
Especially as the character you tie him to is not the character I would have expected. It's like, wow, that's cool. That works.
And I do think that on this subject that I know we've kind of mentioned it already here, but you do a pretty good job of making these people. I mean, before you kind of tell us who they actually are, it becomes really clear that there is something off about these people. Gods, and I think you did a pretty interesting job of kind of making them somewhat alien, which I think is necessary because otherwise, these are people who've lived, as you've mentioned before, some of them are like outside of time, and so you'd have to reconsider like what would that person even be like when we're all growing up and we live for like 60 years. So our experiences are mediated in 60 years. Or what does it look like when you've lived since, whenever? Mm. That effect on how you interact with people. I love Bob because he teaches dance on the beach.
Because like Bob is trying to be a person when he's not. And he kind of knows that. And it's a struggle sometimes. And then you've got someone like Joel who is a person. He's been turned into something else by a power that's kind of out of his control. And Joel doesn't necessarily want to be dragged through time. And Bob doesn't necessarily want to return to his godly status. But the kind of two perspectives on on things.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting aspect to kind of have these various perspectives on immortality or godliness or supernaturalness, power, something of that nature. Yeah, and Joel is just, I think he's a fascinating character because it's interesting to watch him losing control in certain aspects or feeling like, I think one of the early chapters when he has been in the circus and he's built these machines, and there are a couple lines where you describe him as not being sure what is actually going on here, but feeling drawn to it, to what's in the machines, and feeling those as though he's responsible, but not fully understanding what that even means yet.
Yeah, because again, it's a kind of, it's a nameless horror, so he's being pushed because he just happened to find it one day.
And
so he's a bad guy, but he's trapped.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of your characters are like, even Ted, who we barely even mentioned this in the podcast, but I mean, even Ted, there are moments when he starts to realize something is going horribly wrong with him, and that he may have been doing things. I don't want to ruin it because that's part of the discovery, but you know, he feels too like he's losing himself. I think I think that's what's happening, or he feels it's happening. And you know, I think what makes that nameless horror even worse is the idea that if you can't name the thing, you don't have a way to fight it, because you don't even know what you're fighting.
Right.
You know, how do you differentiate what is, you know, a supernatural, horrific object pushing you, and maybe your actual self being pushed, like your psyche being pushed? I mean, it's like that like a lack of control in a moment when you feel like you should have control and you just can't.
Mm.
Yeah. I think that's part of what is maybe quite horrific is losing control.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But that's me. And I don't want to lose control. I don't want creepy machine monsters to... No.
And so darken the world, yes.
Yeah, you're making circuses not sound fun.
Well, he's not the only one. I mean, you have stuff like Aaron Morgenstern and a couple of the writers that have been exploring... Dark Genevieve Valentine exploring these dark circuses lately, and I think you were right what you said before, Adam. This seems to be a tendency that comes and goes in science fiction and fantasy, and now your book is part of another upward swing in the dark side of circuses, and you have that, you have the gods, you have beach dancing. It's quite a stew you have here in the novel.
Yeah, I did like the beach dancing the first time. When he shows up and he's dancing, I just thought that was really amusing because those kinds of people actually exist on the beaches in the Bay Area, particularly, you know, during summer, you could find, you know, just these like random beach dance sessions. And usually it's someone who either is of Latin American descent or just appears like they're of Latin American descent doing dancing. It's one of those moments where you're walking by and it's like 50 women and like one guy.
Yeah.
And it's always hilarious because sometimes their boyfriends or husbands will be hanging around somewhere. And it's like, what are you doing? Like, you need to get in there and learn to dance now. Because, you know, Fancy Pants over there in his like really short shorts he's going to have some fun. But they're kind of amusing. We have in Santa Cruz. I've seen these in Santa Cruz. I think they're really kind of amusing to watch as a social, like, you know, almost like modern anthropology. Just kind of watching how this all works and how the social landscape develops and around beach dancing.
Mm.
But not that that's what you're exploring. Although you do have a really amusing moment where Bob is being. He basically becomes second fiddle to like an 86-year-old woman, which is really amusing. But yeah. Paul, you see, you kind of were jumping in.
Yeah. It's just like these random, strange people on the beach. I mean, there's people like that all across America. I mean, there's no beach dancers here, although we had the root beer lady up in the BWCA who, for decades, lived on an island up there and sold root beer to passing canoeists. It's just like there's all these strange, odd people. So I kind of identified Bob as just as being a strange, random person who beach dances.
Well, there is that. That is really interestingly almost this weird, because he isn't any more unusual than what we would see in real life. And so it makes you really kind of think, like, if these kinds of people really did exist, they could be anywhere. They could be the root beer lady. They could be, yeah, you know, the guy dancing down on the beach. They could be the guy giving out free hugs. Yeah, you know, doing these strange things. Like, how would you identify them? Because, I mean, just looking at the way the world works anyway, there's all kinds of strangeness in our species. Or is there? Maybe they're not human. Yeah, maybe we should hunt them down. But anyway, we're kind of wandering in through a lot of stuff without trying to ruin anything, because there's quite a lot going on in this book in terms of things that you just don't want to ruin. We've already kind of given you, the audience, a good sense of some of the overarching conflict in terms of, like, the cosmic horror and those kinds of things. But I don't want to ruin stuff. So before we do that, I would like to jump really quick to a question that is kind of related to, we just did a podcast with New Zealand fans, authors, about kind of the field of New Zealand. And obviously you now, for the last almost a decade, have lived in the United Kingdom. And so I'm curious, and this may just be a question where you say not at all, but as a New Zealander now living abroad, has that affected your writing in any way?
I don't really know, actually, because I didn't start writing seriously until I moved here, which was about 2006. So it's kind of difficult to answer, actually. Mm. I think certainly over the last 5 years, since maybe 2008, with things like Twitter, especially Twitter, it's kind of less important. My location is kind of less important now, which sounds weird because that's not that long ago, and the internet has been around for much longer. But I think there's a distinctly more, a greater level of interconnectedness, which kind of makes it less important where I am. I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't really feel like I'm a New Zealander living in England writing. I'm just kind of writing.
Fair enough.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question, definitely.
Yeah, I figured there might not be an easy answer, but I figured I had to ask because you never know. I mean,
I think it's because it really was after I moved here that I sat down and like said, okay, I'm going to be a writer and I'm going to do this properly and take it seriously. And if I want to be published, then it's got to be like the number one thing that I do. Mm. And that happened after I moved here. So obviously, although I wrote before, but it was kind of just bits and bobs and short stories and kind of the half-hearted attempts at things when you think, oh, yeah, I'm going to be a writer and it's going to be great and I'll write books and, you know, not there's that kind of level that you have to think to yourself, you need to like turn a switch on and you need to do it differently.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just keep saying, oh yeah, I'm going to write a book one day. Yeah. Someday I'm writing a book. It's taken like 10 years cause I don't actually write anything. I just do it in my head. You know, that's fine. But then there has to be a moment where it kind of changes. It's like, right, sit down, start writing.
Yeah. You got to take it seriously at some point. Either take it seriously or maybe be quiet. Stop saying you're going to do it. Just do it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of like the classic writing advice, you know, when we hear this a lot where you know, someone will constantly say, I want to be a writer. And it's like, well, then why aren't you writing?
But actually, I mean, it's not actually easy.
No, that's true.
Like the story was that I had sent something into a publisher that was open to submissions and it was rejected right at the time when I was moving. And I was like, oh, what do you mean it's rejected? It was so great. And of course it wasn't. It was total rubbish. And I had not done it the right way. And I hadn't had the right attitude. And that's when I realized, it's like, okay, I need to do it properly. But that was actually, it was like a conscious decision and a realization I had, even though for the last however many years of my life, I had thought, yeah, I'm a writer. I can write. I wasn't writing. And I hadn't really been doing anything. I just kind of liked the idea of it. I can pinpoint a moment where I kind of said, this is it. Mm. So it's easy to say, oh yeah, all you gotta do is sit down and start writing. But you kind of just need to stop and think about it and do it.
Make sure you're doing it for maybe the right reasons instead of...
Yeah. Because you have to want to do it, obviously. Because it's not an easy kind of job.
No, I mean, occasionally when I talk to writers about the writing life, I mean, they'll say exactly what you're saying. Like, it's actually kind of gruesome. And can sometimes damage your self-esteem. Like, when you get a rejection, you're like, why? But, so it isn't easy. And I think Scalzi has probably said something to this effect that, you know, it is a real job and you have to actually work at it. It's not just a matter of being creative. You also, like, there are conventions that you have to follow, or at least understand before you can break them. And obviously publishing is a crazy beast and nobody knows what's going to happen next week in publishing. Next week they could decide everybody's going to have pony stories. And it should be about people riding ponies, and that'll be it.
I'll be doing my synopsis for a pony story on Monday morning.
Pony punk.
That's the new thing. Excellent. Well, I see, Paul, you had a hand, so go for it.
I have more general biographical question for Adam. You were born in New Zealand and you moved to UK, and maybe I'm conflating you with someone else, but I thought I read something about you going to move to the U.S. I was curious about what drew you to these hops and skips and across the world.
I mean, at some point I will move to the U.S. I don't know when exactly. Probably not anytime soon. But it's that kind of thing where New Zealand is so far away from everywhere that it's one of the things you can kind of go somewhere else to experience the world. And moving to the U.K. was actually quite easy. Like, I know people say that, you know, moving house is one of the most traumatic experiences you can have. And, I mean, I'm not arguing with that at all. But we kind of, you think, okay, moving to the other side of the planet is quite a big logistical exercise. But then we got here and we got set up and it was okay and it worked. And I'm sure it was stressful and probably things I've forgotten about what happened. But it's like you kind of get this bug. It's like, yeah, well, we could do that again, you know, why not? So the next place would be the US, and then after that, kind of, who knows, because it's not something that everybody does. And it's quite an interesting experience. So we've been here for like 7-8 years or so, if I've got my dates right. So I don't know, definitely. I mean, I like the States. I try to get over there as often as possible for conventions and things. You know, one of my publishers is in New York and my agent's in New York.
Interesting. I'm interested to hear that you said it was actually quite easy. I mean, obviously logistically it can be difficult because, you know, you're picking up and moving, but...
There's a ton of things to do and like with immigration and legal stuff and, you know, but it's possible. It's absolutely possible.
Well, I'm glad to know that because I want to move far away.
Well, I mean, I'm reminded of my friend Damien Walter, who's much more of a nomad. I mean, now he's living in Thailand and he's wondering where is he going to set up shop next. And he was thinking Laos or Malaysia. It's like, that's even more extreme. It's like he just takes his laptop and his goods and goes.
Yeah. I've got like a house full of books.
that is the problem with bibliophiles. Books.
The amount of money it's going to cost for me to move to another country just to bring the books is, and I'm not going to get rid of them. I just can't do that. I love them. They're my friends. it's something that I'm also considering because I'm in academia, but it's all going to come down to whether I get a job somewhere. So. Which is unfortunate because I'm pretty sure you can't just like move to the United Kingdom if you don't have a job, at least not legally.
I have to say with my move, you know, I've got a British passport through my parents, so there was some shortcuts we could make because I'm already a citizen here, which makes it easier. It's possible.
Interesting. Well, I'm going to look into it. You know, not right now because I have to actually finish my PhD first. So, Well, in any case, so all right, these are the winding down questions because we're a little over about an hour, actually. So real quick, I know you have another book coming out this year. So could you tell us a little bit about the other one that's coming out?
Yeah, that's called The Burning Dark. It's out from Tor at the end of March, I think March 25th. It's a sort of dark space opera set 1,000 years in the future about a guy who's a war hero, and he gets sent to this derelict space station in the middle of nowhere, which has been demolished. It's a kind of really strange retirement duty that he's been given, and he doesn't quite know why. And then he gets to the station, and like, they don't know who he is. They kind of don't believe his story. And as the space station is being taken to pieces, kind of weird stuff starts happening. People start seeing things, and there's kind of people moving in the shadows, and people go missing. The station's commander is gone. Nobody knows where he is. People have kind of got cabin fever and are cracking up. And this war hero, Ida, who is sent there, he kind of retreats into himself and makes contact with a kind of a lost signal, which is broadcast out. He picks it up on a space radio, and it's this kind of 1,000-year-old signal from Earth, which he kind of thinks is kind of interesting, and then the signal starts talking to him. And, yeah. And then it kind of goes downhill from there for him, really.
That sounds really interesting.
It's the first of a series. So there's three books to start with, and they're kind of, they're not direct sequels. They're standalone books set in the same universe. And the background is that humanity is at war with this kind of unnamed machine race, which the humans call the spiders because they make kind of these little eight-legged war machines. But people don't really know what they are. They're kind of just this big swarm of insectoid machine intelligence. So yeah, so the book, second book and the third book, they're kind of dealing with the war.
That's going to be really
and
cool.
And weirdness. The kind of weird, it's like weird space opera. There's kind of dark stuff. A lot of psychic stuff because humanity has a part of their battle against the machines is they've developed psychic warfare because the machines use a psychic communications network to communicate with each other. So humans have developed the psychic warfare to kind of disrupt them. So yeah, it's kind of space opera ish.
That's really darkness. Cool. Yeah.
I'm thinking of Fading Suns all of a sudden. How much of a role player are you, Adam? Question.
Not at all, really.
Okay, so you're not stealing from Fading Suns. Okay.
Oh no, I no.
No. No, I'm the role player in the genre sphere, as everyone knows. I keep seeing role playing elements in everything, even when they're not. And clearly they're not, but I'm thinking, ooh, Fading Suns. Psychic warfare, war with humanity, strange locations. I'm on board for this.
Cool. Yeah,
that'll be excellent. So I really am looking forward to that. So I will be yelling at Tor to make sure they send me a copy so I can review it.
Cool.
Because that's just also, you know, spidery insectoid intelligences. That's also kind of just cool. But that comes out in March. Hangwire is already out in the United States. I believe it dropped on January 28th.
Yes, that's right.
So if you're listening now, you should go buy it now. you know, it's available basically in any format imaginable, like except maybe Smoke Signal. Pretty sure it's not available at Smoke Signal.
I think Lee's working on that.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, they're really innovative at Angry Robot, so maybe they'll start doing it that way. okay, so that's great. So we got that. What about you said that you do you have convention appearances, and I suspect you were going to have some this year that you might want to mention to folks.
I'm doing Worldcon this year, which is in London, which is kind of convenient. That's kind of mid-August, I think. And
14th to the 18th.
Right. I'm not sure if I've got any US stuff happening this year, but we will see.
Okay.
Depends
well,
how we go.
At the very least, you will be at Worldcon, and I'm expecting to hopefully be there.
Oh,
so,
excellent.
I will be commandeering your time.
Okay.
So you can be on the podcast again.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, so excellent. So for anyone who is going to Worldcon, Adam will be there, and you can check that out. You can also obviously check out Hangwire, which is currently out, and you can check out his upcoming book in March. But this would be a good time to actually mention where people can find out about you.
Yeah, my website is at adamchristopher.ac, and I'm on Twitter as Ghostfinder.
Excellent. All right, so go check that out. Go check out his books. Obviously, you can also find him on Angry Robot and presumably eventually on Tor's website. Not Tor.com, the publishing website.
Tor, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm up there.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Adam, for coming on and talking to us about yourself and your book.
Thank you very much for having me.
Cool. And thank you, Paul, for being my co-host.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Awesome. And on that note, awkward ending.
Oh, dear.
And scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.
Hey everybody, welcome to the World SF Tour, our special feature throughout the year in which we're obviously celebrating World SF. There are a number of ways you could support this show, just really quick. One is you could subscribe to the show. We're on iTunes, we have the blog, all that good stuff. There's all kinds of cool stuff on the blog, too, you should check out. That's one way you could support us. You can obviously let people know about us. That's really cool when people do that, link to us and all that good stuff. And the other way is actually to go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership. You get a free audiobook out of the deal. You get to try their service if you like it, to keep it, which is cool. And yeah, I mean, that's really that simple. So that helps us as much as the rest of it does. But in any case, thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoy this year, this very specially themed year. And of course, if we missed anything, which we're undoubtedly going to do, feel free to let us know. Send us an email or leave a comment or something. Maybe even on some of our discussion episodes, you let us know about some great works from a certain region that we should be talking about. So in any case, I'll let you get to the episode, and I hope you enjoy it.